Welcome to the Chicago Golf Report Podcast, brought to you by ChicagoGolfReport.com, covering everything golf in Chicago.
Our guest this episode is one of the world's best and most respected golf instructors, Dr. Jim Suttie. Dr. Suttie is a native of the Chicagoland area and has been named Illinois PGA Teacher of the Year and PGA National Teacher of the Year, and has worked with numerous top PGA Tour golfers, including Paul Azinger. So you're currently in Naples, but I'd like to kind of begin with maybe getting a start from your start in terms of growing up in DeKalb and then going to Northern Illinois. Can you talk a little bit about sort of how you found, I guess, the game of golf to begin with?
Oh, yeah, okay. That goes way back. I started when I was a kid, of course. About 6 years old, my dad kind of wanted me to play, so I started playing and liked it. At Kishwaukee Country Club is where I grew up, and I set the course record out there at one time, 63. I don't know if it still stands, but anyway, it was 63. Just grew up, went to Northern Illinois University, got my undergraduate degree, and got my master's there. That's way back. I can hardly remember all that stuff. At that point, went into teaching, not teaching. I went in to be assistant professional for Sherm Finger at Short Acres, where Sherm was. So I was assistant there. And the only thing I remember about Short Acres is I used to hit a lot of shots on my knees, and members loved it, and Sherm hated it. Then I kind of roamed around the state of Illinois. I went to Pine Meadow, I was at Pine Meadow. This was just kind of between coaching careers, though, too. I was kind of a golf coach as well. I did quite a bit of coaching of golf. My first job in coaching was 74 to 78, and that was at Eastern Kentucky University. And we won a couple of OVC championships there. And then I went on from that point to a small little school that they have a golf management program on that I started at Methodist College. And I was also the golf coach. So I was a PGM director and golf coach at Methodist College in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Stayed 3 years there, and you know, I just get so busy teaching, it's hard to do both. So from that point on, Medina Country Club came up, and they actually came to me and recruited me, and they wanted me to come teach there at Medina. So I quit Methodist and went to Medina and stayed there a few years under Bob Hickman. Bob Hickman, I don't know what Bob's doing anymore. But I do remember that. And then at that point, I was teaching at Medina, and the Northwestern University golf coaching job came up. And they wanted me to come over there to coach their golf team. So I coached their team for 4 years at Northwestern. We had pretty good teams over there, and I was trying to do both, but again, can't do both. It can't coach and also teach. So eventually I gave in to what I guess my true love is teaching. And Jeff Morey was my assistant. Jeff is now at Conway Farms. He's been there for about 25 years. So that was where I went at that point. All this time, though, I was always teaching full-time and trying to coach as well. I left an area out, I think, of coaching Brevard Community College. When was that? Yeah, after I left Eastern Kentucky, I went to Brevard. I'm sorry, they'd go to Method. I went straight to Brevard Community College, and that's where I had the Azinger on my team, and we had really good teams there, too. So Paul, of course, you know his thing. He's won 17 tournaments on the tour, and when he came to me, he was a mess. I mean, he couldn't hardly make our top 10. And he just threw hard work on his own, and with my help and John Redmond's help, he became a real golfer, and that's his history on that. So from Brevard Community College, I guess at that point I went to Methodist College, and then I went to Northwestern in that order. But then again, like I say, in all this time I was coaching and teaching, trying to do both, which is an impossible task. So, and particularly at that point, you know, that's where I was at that point. Then got back in the Illinois section quite a few years ago, the Illinois PGA section, when I was at Medina. So I went from Medina to more of a public facility at Pine Meadow working for the Gensics, and stayed there quite a few years at the Pine Meadow, and then they asked me to come down to Cog Hill, which I did. Stayed at Cog Hill for about 12, 13 years, and teaching golf. And then... where did I go from there? Ended up where I am now at Conway Farms, working for Jeff in the summertime, Jeff Morey, and working with Jeff, not for him. And so I teach full time, you know, it's just no coaching anymore. So, but that's kind of it. In between, I did quite a few different things. I don't know if you want to hear all of them, but. Do you want me to continue on some of the stuff?
I guess one big thing, at least it seems to me like it would be a big thing since it kind of changed your title, but I believe in the early 80s you got a doctorate in biomechanics, yes. And then you became Dr. Jim Suddy, which is somewhat unique. Can you talk a little bit about that, and why did you go about going to get a doctorate in biomechanics?
Well, I saw the way golf was going in technology, and so from 82 to 86, I guess, 85, I went to get a doctorate. I attended Middle Tennessee State University, and they didn't have a biomechanics lab, so every weekend I had to drive up to the University of Kentucky at Lexington. And what I did up there was I developed a the first, I know it's the first of its kind, model golf swing, where we took a number of players on the PGA Tour and looked at we looked at the average of their filmed analysis in 10 different positions as they swing from two different angles, looking at virtually all kinds of movement from side movement, how they move their body side to side, up and down, and back and forth. So in all the planes of motion, the sagittal, frontal, and side movement, we looked at all those and got the average of what they did with their body in 10 positions. And we also put markers on the club and did that in the biomechanics laboratory at University of Kentucky. Because, like I say, they didn't have a lab down at Middle Tennessee State University. So so it was what we called a perfect swing. You know, if you wanted to have a perfect swing, it was a stick figure, first of its kind model. And then we put that stick figure model on top of an average golfer. And it's a video of an average golfer. And if the stick figure moved a certain way and you moved a different way, then we call it an error. Well, I knew that was not going to go very far because people can't swing like a perfect golf swing. They can't take a You can't take a model and say, hey, you have to swing this way. Which kind of led me to my theory that I do now that I call matching swing elements. Matching swing elements is simply you look at their body type and their physical structure, their flexibility, their body type, their muscle type. You look at all this and you say, well, what kind of golfer is this in front of me? You know, what can he actually do? And then you design a swing around what the golfer can do. And that's called matching swing elements. And just to give you an example of it, it would be like if a guy has real tight hips, he's not going to be able to move his legs very well. And so therefore, you put the ball back instead of forward. If you put it forward, he'd hit a pull. If you put it back, he'll hit it straight. That's a very simple explanation of it. So, and at the time that I was doing the model swing, we were not looking at the ball flight. And or the ball flight is the primary concern of me now, is looking at the ball flight, then the body, then the club, and the ball flight, the club, and then the body in that order. But you have to look at all three basically. And I was just really into the body motion when I was getting my doctorate. So let's see. That probably was kind of an interesting era of my life there, to getting that doctorate. So
now, you know, you talked about how you saw the future of technology. Now, you know, back in those days when you went to get your doctorate, how then
right.
do you incorporate technology today? Do you still, you know, feel that's a significant part of what you do?
Yeah. See, when I left from since after the perfect swing experience, I said, well, what is going to really work for people? And I thought maybe high-speed video had a future, and nobody was doing high-speed video. I was running around with a thumping on my back and with a camera all the time and videoing people with high-speed video, and I'd go from two or three angles, you know, trying to get the what they do when they actually swing a golf club. And I started what I called the video computer graphics and side-by-side comparison, where I would do computer graphics, which everybody's doing now, but I think I was about the first, if not the first, and side-by-side comparison where I'd tape somebody of a certain golfer's body type and put them side by side on the video and say, well, look what he does because of what his body's doing, and look what you're doing because of what your body's doing. And so they could relate with that visual experience, which I think is real important in teaching golf, is people can't identify too much with the spoken word only because they forget everything. So I got into the visual part of it, and even had at one time when I was at Medina, I had a learning center with a four-camera system, an indoor-outdoor system that we called Visual Golf. And that was kind of the first of its kind, too, I believe, when I was at Medina. I don't remember anybody doing indoor-outdoor training with cameras like I had. I had four angles, side, down the line, rear, and top. And that's when I really got into the technology end of it. And companies since then, like V1 or Interactive Frontiers, have kind of taken over that role in video. And I use it a little differently in the sense that I still have four cameras and I have a monitor on the ground. And they're looking right in the monitor when they're swinging, and they get feedback on every swing to see if they're doing it. And with no feedback, basically, there's no learning. And so, therefore, the learning part started becoming very important. I understood basically, that, you know, you can show them that, but if they go back and think they're doing it and not really doing it, it's because they're not getting feedback. So computer graphics, side-by-side comparison, in the indoor-outdoor training centers that I think I had a lot to do with, I think was part of my experience as I was becoming a better and better teacher at that point. So,
when you read a sort of the summaries, I know Golf Digest recently came out with their top instructors, you know, by state within the country. A lot of times you hear, I guess, maybe not the instructors themselves, but you see other people sort of categorize people as being old school versus new school. But it seems like you've always been new school, you know, even though you've been around and you've been able to work with a lot of different, you know, professional players and others, you know, it's always seems like you've always had a your hand on the pulse of technology. And, you know, I'd be interested in hearing, like, what your thoughts are on the importance of that technology versus, or, you know, maybe the difference between old and new school. Like, can you still, you know, help somebody identify ball flight and club in their body without technology, or do you think it's more of an enhancement to have that capability?
Well, I think you should have some technology, but it can be overdone. Definitely, to be really truthful, and I'm not being critical or bringing up names, but I think we overdo it right now. I mean, we're using almost too much of it. I think it's for the teacher to verify what they are teaching, basically. So, for example, I have a force platform, and I use the force platform to see how their weight moves. But, you know, I did a study with Henry Griffin in 1990 that was actually the first, I think, one of the first force platform and weight transfer things that were done in the United States. And now it's coming to fruition how important the weight movement is and sequence of motion. But to answer your question, I think that we do overuse it a little bit. We rely on it because it's easy to use, I guess. But you still have to have a feel for what this person's doing, and he's in front of you for a reason. He wants to improve his ball flight. He's not interested in how his left knee is moving. He's more interested in what is happening at the bottom of his swing. So, therefore, the ball flight, I think, is extremely important. And the launch monitors like the TrackMan are important. I have that. I have the Force platform. I have SamPut. I have all this stuff, but the way I use it is in a kind of a varied way. I don't want people to rely on it. I want them to understand what they do, and then me come up with a solution of how to make it make sense of it for them instead of becoming too reliant on the technology. But I've seen the technology in the situations we're in now being used too reliant on it, especially the young teachers. So they get too reliant on the technology. So you have to do it this way, you have to do it that way. That's not true. There's no have-tos when you learn the golf swing. Does that help?
You talked about Paul Azinger, and he's such an interesting case study because of the fact that he's got somewhat of a different approach, you know, a strong grip and, let's say like a different swing. What could you tell the average golfer here in Chicago? What can you pull from, say, a Paul Azinger that could help them? Maybe it's in terms of Azinger's approach to the game or, you know, how he became so great at the wedge play. What bits of information would you pick from Paul Azinger to say, you should take this from Paul towards the average golfer here in Chicago?
Very good question. Most people are, I would say most golfers now want tips. They don't want you to redo their swing. But Paul learned with a strong grip under John Redman, and I left it alone. But again, matching swing elements, strong grip, strong swing. If you have a strong grip, you're likely to draw the ball, and it's going to make you use your hips a little bit. So, you know, teachers need to know that stuff, the training of teachers, where they just some teachers don't understand why he did that. It's the way his arms hang at address. He put his arms to his hands kind of turned in at address when he stood up. So therefore, it fit him a stronger grip, where a weaker grip like Corey Pavin has would never have fit him, and you would never heard of Paul Azinger. But what I'm saying to you is, an average guy in Chicago needs to understand that, you know, there are certain fundamentals that they have to have, but they are not written in stone. Like, a grip can be strong, neutral, or weak, but it has to do a lot with what what the face is doing at impact and what creates that good impact for that particular person. So it's a good question, but every person that plays golf in Chicago or anywhere else has an individual pattern, and it's up to the teacher to figure out that individual pattern and work with that.
Another player that you worked with for a long time and became quite known for is Lauren Roberts. And
oh yeah,
what would you take from Lauren Roberts? Obviously, he was known as a fantastic putter. Is there anything that you would take from him that you would say to an average golfer, this is what you could use from him as well?
Yeah, see, Lauren has short arms and wide shoulders, and his chest is kind of big. So he has to have the right balance at address, posture. His hands will be low at address. So, again, looking at how his body is built dictates a lot about how he's going to swing. But Lauren doesn't hit it a long ways. He's more of a what we call a releasing type of swing, not a body player, more of a – most players on the tour are body players. Lauren's not as much of a body player. He's more of an arm swinger, or he does things together. So, again, his flexibility is not really good. So, I mean, it's good. It's better than most, but it's not as good as some of the guys you see on the tour. So, therefore, his hips are not going to be fast. So those are all the things that I look at when I look at a swing. So it's looking at the body, eyeballing what his natural pattern is, and kind of working with that natural pattern. I'm not trying to say, Lauren, you got to really turn your hips hard here. Well, he can't do that, so we're fighting going up a wall there. So, again, we go right back to what works for the individual, what the body is going to allow you to do, and what type of ball flight that you want to hit. So, and that's what I've just done with Lauren, to find the ball flight and the natural pattern that works for him.
For those of us who can't get to Naples during the winter, do you have any suggestions on golfers to either improve their game if they have the time to work on it, or at least try to keep things kind of the motor running throughout the winter here, whether that's working on simulators in the golf domes or heated? Any suggestions for the average golfer to keep their game going during the winter in Chicago?
Well, even if they can't go to the indoor area centers and stuff like that, if they can swing a club, put a towel on the end of a driver and swing it all winter. That's a real simple drill. They'll end up feeling the club head more and have more lag and delay in their swing. Just swinging a towel on the end of a driver is one of the best exercises I've seen in the wintertime for people. And also, you know, they can do video now. So I do a lot of online video with V1. They can send it to a teacher or me, you know, it, regardless of it. The V1 is free, I think, to put on your thing. And you can take a video of your swing from two angles and send it to your favorite teacher. And and have him analyze it, send it back to you in two or three things, and you could keep learning through the winter months. And that way you don't lose your teacher for 6 or 8 months, whatever that is. But there's a lot of opportunities indoors also up there that are real good.
Okay, I have a couple more questions for you. Number one, what's your take on, you know, you mentioned coming from Northern Illinois University. You also were involved with Northwestern. Both of those have programs have really risen to prominence, Northern Illinois and their connection to Rich Harvest Farms, having the NCAAs last year. And then obviously
right.
Pat Goss and Northwestern have become a very, I guess you would call a machine in terms of turning out great teams. How does it feel to look back on those programs and your involvement and now to see sort of the prominence that they've risen to?
Oh, well, it's really great. I'm really honored that I was a coach there at Northwestern, and also I was assistant coach at Northern Illinois when Jack Phoenix was the coach. I did most of the coaching there when I was getting my master's, but I remember when Pat came into my office. He was at Marshall University, and he said, "I want to transfer." It's the best decision he ever made in his life. And so I let him transfer and get on the team, and he has done a wonderful job there. Coaching now, though, has become recruiting. You know, you have to go to the tournaments, to make the calls, do the recruiting. It has very little to do with what I did when I was coach, which I actually didn't recruit real well, but I got them. I taught them real well, I think, and they always finished pretty good in the Big Ten. So it was a little different in my era, and because coaches were just getting into the recruiting process, but now it's all recruiting. So, but that was really a fun time in my life for a. Did coach young kids, and it was kids were they responded well to what I did.
This has been the Chicago Golf Report podcast. Visit chicagogolfreport.com right now for exclusive discount offers, Chicago golf news, and in-depth event listings.